I am delighted to welcome you to the first Payments and Cards Network podcast. My name is Lewis Howard, Managing Director of PCN USA, as well as a fanatic podcast junkie myself. In this first series, we will have a recording of the latest industry meetup organised by Payments and Cards Network, which deals with open banking in Europe, but also takes on a more global perspective on the developments in regions such as China, Australia and North America. If you'd like to get more information or would like to get involved in our podcast series, please make sure to write to marketing@teampcn.com. That's marketing@teampcn.com, and we'll be sure to get back to you. For now, sit back, relax, and enjoy the panel discussion on open banking with Robert Krull, former CEO of Adyen, Tom Greenwood, co-founder of IFX Payments, Stefan Vollett, independent payments and fintech consultant, and the moderator of our discussion is Rachia van der Voort, COO of Payments and Cards Network.
All right. Welcome back, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, for the second part of the program, which is the panel discussion on open banking. Joined with me here tonight is part of the founding team of Vault. There's one guy missing, which is Jordan Lawrence, who was supposed to sit here. I'll do the honors for him, because he or his girlfriend gave birth yesterday. So you can't join us. Maybe to start off, for everyone, to do a bit of an introduction. Stefan, you want to kick it off?
Sure, thank you. Well, thanks for hosting us tonight. Also, thank you all for coming here. So I'm Stefan Vollett. I have actually worked quite a long time alongside Robert Krull at Adyen. And for the past year, I've been freelancing, contracting, mainly helping to kickstart new fintechs and also working for several investment funds, supporting them with market exploration and evaluation of investments.
Hi guys, I'm Tom Greenwood. I'm the founder of IFX Payments. It's a $2.5 billion turnover foreign exchange business that I founded in 2005. I'm still a shareholder in that business, but not actively involved in an executive capacity. Now collaborating with a team of thought leaders, including Robert Krull and Stefan, on a new project called Vault, which we can tell you more about probably in 6 months.
Secret. Well, I'm Robert Krull. I've worked for about 20 years in the payment space in the Netherlands. First, a company called Bibit. We sold that to Royal Bank of Scotland in 2004, was merged with Worldpay. Later on, also as operations director for Doc Data Payments and CEO for Adyen as well, and several other jobs. At this moment, I'm particularly focusing on the startup scene in payments across the globe, either as an investor or as a consultant.
Cool. Thank you very much. So maybe to start the discussion, if there's any questions from the audience, feel free to raise your hand. It's supposed to be an interactive session. Tom, maybe to start off with you.
Yeah.
Open banking is a buzzword that's been around, I think, for several months.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, can you give maybe a bit of an explanation of what open banking is and maybe what is the role of Vault, if you can give a hint?
Yeah, sure. open banking is a part of the Payment Services Directive 2. I hope I get all this right, because I think one of the senior people from ECB is here tonight. It's part of the Payment Services Directive 2. It's one facet of that, and it's the most transformative piece of financial regulatory change in this generation. There are two main angles to it. One is account information, which is called AISP. I won't get too lost in jargon because I might lose some of you, but basically banks are mandated to provide an API and publish that API publicly, make it public, so that any other authorized institution can access your account information with your consent. So that's half of it. The other half is called payment initiation service provision. So that means that any authorized or regulated entity that you work with, you can pass them an instruction in your consent, and they can pass that to your bank without you speaking to your bank in the first instance, and that bank must act on that instruction within 4 minutes. So it's extremely detailed legislation, but fundamentally, if you think about what you can do with your bank, you can do two things, I think. You can look at information, you can review your statement, look at transaction information, which is the account information service provider. Or you can make a payment or make an instruction for payment. There aren't too many other things that you can do. If you log into your bank, you can review information and you can initiate a payment. So where your bank used to be in Ireland, and if you bank with ABN AMRO, you had to use ABN AMRO app, and if you bank with Rabo, you had to use Rabo app. The whole financial ecosystem of bank accounts pan-Europe are now interconnected. And this is mandated by law by the 14th of September, 2019, unless there are some banks that have been granted an extension. But all banks must, by the 14th of September, provide this API, which provides access to any other regulated entity that you're working with to provide account information and payment initiation services, which in effect is all you can do with your own bank anyway. So it is transformative on a scale that I don't think any of us understand quite yet, but it's certainly a very exciting space. About Vault, I won't say too much. I'm working with a bunch of thought leaders. Robert has agreed to be our chairman, and there are a number of others in this room. And we're just exploring a few things at the moment, particularly around payment initiation. The only thing I'll say further is this, that if you think fundamentally, getting back to that word again, fundamentally why Visa, MasterCard, Amex exist, consumers have always had bank accounts, and so have businesses. But if I'm going into a shop to buy a beer or a pack of fags or a toy or a jumper, how do you connect those banks at point of sale? It's impossible, right? Well, payment initiation turns that on its head, because those bank accounts are now connected legally as of the 14th of September. So there's a lot of investigation going on by a lot of very intelligent teams across the European corporate scape at the moment, I'm sure. I'm lucky enough to be working with five or six guys who are all much more intelligent than I am. So, we're excited about what potentially we can do. But, yeah, we're looking at payments in particular and how that could be potentially quite transformative.
Exciting. Robert, what would you say are the main advantages of this open banking regulation that comes to effect September?
Yeah, I think that there are actually a lot of different advantages. So what you see is, and I get this particular because I talk to a lot of startup companies, that there are a number of different initiatives that are being deployed. So there's a whole group of companies that is trying to focus on making the payment experience better. So they use the AISP and the PISP messaging to either create a new payment method with own rules in either a country or a region, and essentially say, okay, I want to make the payment process cheaper, better, easier, more consumer friendly, and we add a number of different services on top of that that are related to the payment. But I think there's more than that as well. What you also see is that there are many companies that are focusing actually on aggregating account information from different bank accounts. So that could be your bank account with ING or with Rabo, with ABN. Many people have multiple bank accounts, and that actually all that information is aggregated for different reasons. Could be simply to provide a single overview of all your balances at the same time. But you also have models that, for instance, look and say, okay, what are your recurring costs? Which subscriptions do you have? How much do you pay for electricity on a monthly basis? Or how do you pay for telephone or whatever? Can I give you an offer based on your actual information that actually is a better offer than you have at this moment? And that could be for a lot of those recurring things. So think of mortgage, telephone, electricity, etc. Things that you normally are reviewing once every couple of years. Can I get a better deal? And a whole other group of companies actually looking at more management of those funds, and that can be for people to manage their personal finance. I get this amount of money in at the end of the month. That's my salary or other income that you have. I want to reserve X for my housing costs, X for my travel costs, another part for my savings, and another part for my hobbies or whatever, so that you can actually on the account already start making reservations on different pots where you want to spend that money on in a later stage. And that's for convenience, so that you're not stuck at the end of the month that you've overspent your drinking budget and that you cannot pay your electricity anymore. So that's an easy tool. But it can also be used for by companies to actually manage, for instance, or help you as a consumer to manage your debt position. So if you're a person that apparently is spending more than that you get in, how do you make sure that you prioritize between your most important expenses versus your lesser important expenses. And that's, yeah, if you have not enough money at the end of the month, it should go out of your drinking budget and not out of your housing budget, for instance. So you actually see that on the base of the pure the information, so all these tools that I described are information based and not payment initiation based, but I also see a lot of different companies that actually work on doing something with that information and developing tools, apps or other tools for consumers so that they can help their personal finance better. So yeah, again, what are the advantages? The advantages is that these open APIs, they allow for an enormous amount of new companies thinking of new business models, and it also allows them to expand quite rapidly into Europe, because essentially the regulation is the same for the whole European Union.
Does it also mean that a lot of companies will now need to change their business model based on?
I think that for existing companies, there are I would definitely look into the new toolkit that they have and to see if they can bring benefits for their existing business model. So yes, I would recommend everybody who's active in payments at this moment look how your current business can benefit from this, either offering more service to your customers, retail or consumers, or reducing internal or external costs, whatever. But I also expect, and that's actually what I see, is that a lot of very young companies are starting up across the whole of Europe with a lot of fantastic different ideas in roughly in the different direction that I've explained.
Does a new company, you think, have a competitive advantage now with this, and maybe because of all other companies or existing companies having old infrastructure hanging behind, or is that not even?
I think for new companies, always the advantage is that they're not bound by old technology, so they can really be very flexible with the demands of the customer at this moment, whether the customer is a consumer or a retailer. So you have the speed, you can focus on what you want to do, and you don't have the burden of taking care of the other infrastructure. But it depends a bit on the organization, how much developers you have, how isolated you can develop these new tools, and how well you can integrate it in your existing business. So I don't think there's one rule set for all, but fact is that there are a lot of young entrepreneurs, young developers with interest in this field with payment knowledge, saying, okay, listen, we've got a new idea. And quite often they focus on one idea. I can imagine at a certain moment that some of these companies, they merge, and that you actually get products that have a lot of different aspects, all making use of the same ASP or PSP or those type of messaging.
Any disadvantages as well, Stefan? Or disadvantages, weaknesses?
I think there's several ones to be aware of. I mean, we can just look at the presentation of Daniel, where he explained that in China it was necessary to introduce a intermediate layer to actually monitor the operations and the functioning of the system and to make sure that everybody gets access to it at an adequate service level. So I think that's something that something that needs to be thought through, how this actually needs to be monitored operationally, the functioning of this new open banking. How banks live up to the SLAs they should and need to achieve. So that will be a key criteria. But also, if you look just at the consumer side, and so one weakness could be that many more people and many more companies will have access to my data, and who's actually monitoring those, and what's the quality of that monitoring, and what's their security standards, because they don't have PCI, they have no certificates. So the banks need to monitor those TPPs and what is the guideline? How is it going to work? How is it going to work across countries? No?
Which is where GDPR comes into play, right?
Partially, yeah. Mm. But generally, the security, data protection, how do you approve a TPP? How do you check the integration to the bank? And so I think from a consumer perspective, we really need to be prepared for some pushbacks or to some surprises there, data breaches. So that's something I would definitely look out. Also as a TPP, the struggle to actually connect to all those banks or to create this layer in between connecting to those banks. Maybe in Holland it's nice because there's a limited number of banks, but if you look at Germany, which is a very, very fragmented, complicated market, how's it going to play out? You have Figo, which bought the home banking interface, the patent for that. But okay, so how are you going to compete with a player like this? And also, we have still fairly locked up markets which have historically grown own solutions like Poland with Blik and who are very protective. So that is something. So how will it really work, this opening up of the banks? And of course, also there's a huge shift of risk towards the banks. So they're basically, without any additional compensation really, being put in charge of a huge infrastructure project, of investment projects, security monitoring, facilitating payment initiation, partially doing the KYC. So how what is the split between KYC, AML, the responsibilities of the bank, what are the responsibilities of the TPP? And all these things are still zones, gray zones that we need to explore and that we need to understand, and that at some point will probably require additional regulatory adjustments, at least my expectation.
Do you think that also the role of the banks are going to change with this?
Yes, of course, the banks have now the problem that they are removed further from the customer. No? So there's an intermediary who will take over the direct customer relationship, which means how are you going to cross-sell anything? How are you going to make profit? How are you going to understand your customer? How are you going to run risk models on transactions when you don't have all this data, or the data goes through an intermediary? So on the bank side, the whole modulation of risk needs to be reassessed and revamped, and you also need to, in parallel, deal with SCA, so the strong customer authentication. And how are you going to reflect all those huge changes? No? And that's basically the question.
Cool. Any questions from the audience in the meantime? Yeah.
The legislation, is it the same for consumers as for companies, the account holder?
There is some threshold. It's a good question. It certainly applies to consumers. I think it applies to small businesses as well, up to a certain balance sheet. At the top of my head, I mean, I might be speaking absolute crap. Yeah. the open banking doesn't apply to very large businesses. I know that.
Well, the PSD legislation applies to everybody.
Yeah.
Of course, so it's just a legal implementation of the PSD framework in the domestic. But there are some differences for what you can do with information for companies, payment service providers, ASP, essentially licensed companies versus consumers, what you can do with that.
Mm-hmm.
But the legislation applies for everybody.
You expect somebody to come out of the woodwork and come up with Volt or something to all of a sudden seize on the PSD2 opportunity. What about first mover versus fast follower? Because the fast followers have the trust. How do you look at that? I mean, what's proven with an API can be quickly followed by somebody who's got a lot of technology behind it and developers behind it as well. So how do you stand, first mover, fast followers?
First mover is a key consideration in business startup. I think entrepreneurialism, as I understand it, is typically formed by invention and creativity, or by a change in the exterior landscape, be that regulatory, technologically, whatever. It creates new horizons and it opens new doors that weren't there before. And I think generally you need to be, if you're a clever entrepreneur, you need to be aware of those shifts and you need to make sure that you're taking advantage of them. So timing is certainly crucial, and PSD2 is certainly one of those moments where tectonic plates are shifting and it creates opportunity. The whole mission behind PSD2 is to level the playing field, and it's to drive innovation and to drive customer choice. That's what the regulator was all about. And it certainly does that, and it does that on a seismic scale. First mover or fast follower, I think that's subjective. I think being first mover is always an advantage, but being a fast follower, you're not too far behind. So it really depends on the team that you have, the resources that you have. I think there's a window of opportunity for PSD2, which goes on for a couple of years yet at least, where entrepreneurs can take advantage and build new solutions.
Yeah, and other questions, of course, also how will it really impact consumer behavior? No? So will somebody who pays with ID all the time switch to open banking solution? Will that happen? How will also, who will really be the competitor? No? So will it be Trustly, Sofort, the online banking screen scrapers, or will it be cards? Will it play out like in India with UPA or in China? So how will it really impact the market? So at the moment, I think it's impossible to predict what will be really the business model. No? So right now you can do best guess, define your pricing, and just try to sell.
I think at the beginning, we as consumers, we will be a bit worried about giving access to everybody, between the brackets, to our bank. So what we have more safer is where our finances are. Mm. So we will be reluctant to do that. All the compliance issues that you are mentioning, risk and security, they will all play a very big role in that. Mm. But once there is somebody like maybe Volt or another TPP that comes with a very fancy, cool kind of invention, we as a consumer, I think that will be So I'm going to open my bank account, actually, because this is the future and I want to be part of it.
So
I guess that could be really the moment that everything is switching.
Well, I think I fully agree with you, and that will be different market by market. Mm-hmm. So it's always difficult to change consumer behavior because they're used to their existing payment method, whether it's cars or cash or PayPal or any other payment method, ideal in the Netherlands. So changing consumer behavior is difficult, and it will be difficult different in all the markets because all the payment behavior is different in all the markets. So I would expect that some markets will be relatively easy simply because there is fewer competition when it comes to smart payments or simple payments. Other markets where you already have products that work reasonably well, it might be a bit more complex to get full traction there, but I think you're fully right. You need to offer your consumer something extra, and that something extra may be slightly different market by market.
So, like you say, Europe is quite different when it comes to payment habits and how banks are acting, are responding. Which market is Volt going to attack first?
You keep on asking me questions about this. UK.
Okay.
Because that's where the banks are most advanced in implementation, and that's where the first commercial opportunities are.
When you look at the south of Europe, then they say, well, we don't need these banks. That's really what they told me. It's a cultural thing, they say.
Yeah.
I see a lot of opportunities there as well.
Yeah.
Sorry, what was the question?
South of Europe. Yeah, you're right. But I think that it's difficult to launch. You need to launch a solution country by country because you don't want to launch partial solutions in the country. You want to say, okay, it's full coverage. Mm. And with that, you have to look at what is essentially where is the business advantage the largest. So Southern Europe, a number of different markets indeed is on the list as well. And where is the market at this moment already ready, essentially, for these type of solutions? So where are the banks ready and prepared for that?
I think
you're quite right. Picking the right countries. Yeah. In some countries, well, maybe indeed, in some countries they don't think themselves that it's going to get a huge traction, but let the consumer decide.
They got millennials as well.
Sorry?
They got millennials as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And
I think it's interesting also, for those who are not aware, open banking is not just a European thing now. Australia, rolling it out next year. Canada, Japan, I think 88% of banks are connected to an open banking network. As you heard from Daniel Zian earlier, what made Jack Ma the multi-billionaire that he is actually forcing this commercially upon the banks. And they have it in China in a form, Singapore, Hong Kong, and in the US as well. So it's, as with GDPR, a lot of regulation starts here in Europe because the biggest financial institutions are here and because the biggest regulators are here, and the thought leaders in financial services globally are typically here. But whilst it starts here, it then tends to sort of emanate globally, and that's certainly happening with open banking.
Yeah, I think it's actually something that we in Europe can actually be proud of, no? That we have a regulator who's pushing something like this. No? So when I was on missions abroad and people look at Europe for the regulation efforts that are undertaken to break out or break like the financial system, no? And to provide access for startups to innovate. So I think it's a very brave move of the European Union to do this. And I think it will be really interesting market-changing startups. In other markets, you see also in the US, you have some startups which are extremely successful, like Plaid from the US, who also did it like Jack Ma, bank by bank, and all those startups always worked.
Question here in the back, yeah.
Sorry, a bit of a personal question. Will you be willing to give your consent by September this year?
Will I?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, I think for some people like us that have held senior positions in large financial organizations and dealt with the banks and regulators extensively, we understand how rigorous their systems are and their controls are. And we understand the restraints that are placed on us and the responsibilities. And we understand the consequences if we don't get that right as well. So if you have that sort of understanding of how intrinsic the regulation is and how serious it is, and I'm completely relaxed about giving another regulated institution who I know is under the same rigorous infrastructure and series of rules and regulations that I've operated under for the last 15 years. Because financial institutions are pretty well-run organizations these days, believe it or not. It's hard to believe after 2008, but there's been a hell of a lot of change in the financial regulatory landscape, which has nailed down a lot of it. You're never going to have a perfect system, of course, but your money is safe, you know, with regulated institutions generally, in Europe certainly, and your data is safe with them as well.
In what type of parties did she speak to?
Payment institutions.
Payment institutions, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Startups.
So it depends what you're talking about, but a lot of the payments companies are wrestling with SCA at the moment, which is strong customer authentication. And they're way behind. They're scrambling. They've got to be ready by September 14th. And
I mean, also, I think generally it's going to play out like the implementation of PSD one already with Zebra Direct Debit. So it took 2 years actually until everybody had some sort of kind of working integration and availability. I expect the same with the new regulation. And also the other problem will be to really operationally monitor it. No? So how is it going to work? No? Because with direct debits and the previous regulation, it just never worked really. And there were no consequences really for banks. So what's going to happen if they,
In fact, a friend of mine was in a meeting, he's in this room somewhere, with Visa, MasterCard, Amex, and various others just a couple of months ago. And they were having a massive argument about whose responsibility SCA is. So they don't even know which link in the chain is responsible for enforcing it. Mm-hmm. And it's complete shambles.
I think that another question is, at this moment there is already regulation as well. So this new regulation, companies will get a license or they don't get a license, and there's supervision on those companies, so they have to comply with the regulations. If they don't comply, they don't get their license or they have to mitigate that. But you could also ask the question at this moment, how confident are you giving your credit card number to a current regulated company? And if you're confident,
or a not regulated company,
or a not regulated company, probably you would say, well, if it's a regulated company, one of the many payment service providers that are here, or payment companies, yeah, many of them are regulated. And quite often you don't even know which company that is. But you could ask yourself the same questions. Are you comfortable at this moment giving consent for either a single card authorization or a recurring card authorization for certain business models? And essentially you have confidence in the regulator and in the license institute at that moment that they take your card data, in this case, very safe. So I think that's the confidence level. You can compare that to a degree.
I think the main difference is that you can dispute that card injection, you can't dispute an open banking.
That is true, but you can also only dispute your card to a certain degree if there's fraud. And there is some dispute regulation. Well, that's the same with Ideal, by the way. Huh? So with Ideal, if from that, every payment method has a balance between how much risk does the retailer get, how much risk does the consumer get. Some payment methods, you're guaranteed to lose your money. Think of Ideal or a bank transfer or a PSD2, AISP, PSP, open banking transaction. So that risk is the same for many of those payment methods. And other payment methods, you have chargeback possibilities. So think of credit cards or direct debit mandates, and there are a number of other ones. That is not necessarily something different for open banking based payment methods. That's already there, and you're right, it happens. But that is more to do with how much confidence do you have in the retailer where you buy this product? Do you think that if you buy this product, that I actually get it delivered? And if you have that confidence, you will just as likely pay with Ideal or do a bank transfer or an open banking transaction if you have confidence in that retailer. And if for whatever reasons you don't have the confidence in the retailer, you might choose for another payment method option. But I don't think that is necessarily strictly related to open banking as such. There are payment methods that cannot be disputed. You lost your money and you hope that you get a good service from the retailer.
Another question there.
Yeah. How long have you got? Yeah, no, it's a fairly exhaustive application process.
Essentially, you have to demonstrate that you're compliant with existing rules and that you have the tools in place to make sure that all the processes that you have to carry out, that they are carried out, and also that you have monitoring tools to make sure that you can monitor that the people do the tasks that they do. And
is it like a one-time effort? So once I get the license, I'm free to do whatever I want?
No, you have to describe your process, your internal processes. They have to be compliant, and you have to put a framework in place that makes sure that you can always test and demonstrate, actively demonstrate that in all cases you are compliant. So if any of the regulator comes in at any moment, they say, okay, this is the process that we've approved, and these are the monitoring tools that we've approved for you to monitor those processes. Well, show me. How did you do the last 20 customers or 100 customers or whatever? Just show me. And you have to constantly prove that you actively can demonstrate compliance.
Yeah, can be expected that the regulators also will regularly visit all the startups and test them? Or is it more on a reactive basis? So once a customer complains,
Probably they will initially have a more active approach. So they will, of course, at the moment that you do your application, they will run through your processes, your monitoring tools to the team, etc. And they also have a sort of risk assessment. Say, okay, is this a complete new team who've never done this before, or is this a team with a lot of experience? And in theory, they can audit, and probably in the beginning they will audit more customers, and definitely they look at the volumes, how much volume do you process, more volume is a bigger risk as far as they are concerned. They look at customer complaints coming in, either from the retailer side or the consumer side. If they get in more complaints, that would be a trigger for them as well to step by and follow your processes. So they have a number of triggers where they will be looking for, but I think that you should build your business in the sense that they can come in every day, and that with open eyes, with an honest view, you can say, okay, listen, these are my processes, these are my monitoring tools, and yes, you can have a look, and my dossier, my file, my processes are just run as they should be. And there will always be some improvements, but your initial view should be, if you build this company, say, okay, no, I want to be compliant, because you don't want to mess with the regulators in general.
But it still goes back a little bit to this like network, no? So like payments are built on trust, no? So with Visa, MasterCard, card schemes, there's trust created by Visa, MasterCard, because they have standards for all participants in the payments value chain. And those standards apply to everyone to the same level, and there's a checklist you can go through, and you get audited, and only when you pass the audit, you can go live. But with open banking, you're probably going to see national deviations, varying standards, which you already have with e-money and financial institution licenses. So if you want a quick license due to Brexit, you go to Lithuania or Malta. And if you want a proper license with investors or investor readiness, you go to UK or Holland. You know? And I think a similar pattern might evolve in the future as well, that you have more lenient regulators and others more strict.
Some questions.
In the context of consumer trust, because you mentioned the regulatory mechanisms and licenses in one breath, as if it has the same value in each member state, but as you mentioned just now, we are aware of the differences.
Exactly.
They are enormous. So how are you going to deal with consumer trust in open banking standards if, let's say, there are rogue regulatory...
There are certain consistencies, though, which are non-negotiable. Sure. And one thing that is really important with open banking is every authorization for every transaction happens within what's called the ASPSP's own environment. So the issuing bank, as in if you bank with ABN AMRO, the ASPSP is ABN AMRO. The authorization that you give ABN AMRO for that payment must happen in ABN AMRO's own environment, be it their app or their online banking platform. That's the only place that you can authorize the transaction.
Yes, but that's the result. What I'm concerned about is, hey, you also mentioned, if
So you're going back to the licensing part of the TPP. Yeah. Who actually checks the TPP, right? Yeah.
Well, maybe I can jump in here a little bit, because I think that it's a very valid question, but it's not particular for open banking. It's in general, it's a compliance question. How much confidence do you have in a regulated company, whether it's a bank license or a PSD license or an ASB, how much confidence do you have in the regulatory oversight of those companies in different countries? And from my perspective, it doesn't really matter if I would pay with credit card. I want to have confidence in the payment provider who accepts my credit card. If it's an open banking transaction, I would want to have as a consumer, but I know more than the average consumer. So you need to have the confidence that if these companies from a regulatory point of view are allowed to do these payments in the country where they are, that they at least must meet a minimal threshold of providing this customer security. And you're right, there are companies who probably, definitely to our views, because I know that you're very deep in this as well, but to our view say, okay, they don't meet what I would consider as my minimal thresholds. Well, the regulator thinks there is a minimal threshold, but for me there wouldn't be a difference if I would give them my credit cards or if I would give them my open banking instructions. Because in both cases, it's a company that does not meet my threshold. And I think that the whole regulatory system in Europe is intended to say, okay, let's raise the barrier for new entrants, let's raise the barrier for existing companies as well, and let's make sure that people have confidence in the total spectrum of payments, whether this is credit card or direct debit or open banking or whatever. So your question is right, but to my view, it's more a compliance. How much confidence do you have in the regulatory oversight of different regulators? Very valid question, but to my opinion, it is a separate discussion from the open banking discussion that we're having here, because you could apply it for all other payment methods as well.
Last question, guys. Zach.
So there seems to be a lot of questions around trust. So I'm going to just say a statement and then ask a question, and my statement might not be compliant. So I would question how many of you, if I gave you a 1% discount on your 1,000 euro flight, would pay with open banking rather than a credit card, and would still be win-win for both. I think if you had an open banking 1,000 euro flight, you get a free check seat, would you do it, or would you pay with your credit card and get a random seat?
Do you work for a card company?
I work for a travel company. So, just as an example, because for us, fraud, all this fun stuff is out there. So the question I'd ask is, you mentioned earlier, there's two pieces to open banking. One is being able to view your current account, and the second is making a transaction. So I'll ask all three of you, and let's use the UK for this example. What do you think in 5 years we will be? What percent of e-commerce transactions do you think will be on open banking, and what percent of consumers regularly use sites that use open banking to see, organize how much they spend and stuff like this? Trust,
well,
right?
It's exactly. Well, I think that you're probably looking at 5 to 10% of all transactions in that direction, and it will differ in different segments. So you can imagine that business models who have a very strong recurring business type, so you order something via your app and it's immediately withdrawn. For those type of companies who are behind it, depends a bit on your average transaction value. Obviously, if your average transaction value is high, it makes more sense to have a fixed cost payment method. If your average transaction value is low, it's more a percentage. But depends a bit on the business model, whether it will be adapted. But if you can convince the consumer that they get a better deal by using these payment methods, so free seats, for instance, but it can also be free shipping or whatever you can think, or loyalty points or discounts or whatever, I think that you're able to attract a lot of consumers by offering those type of things.
I think 5 years is a long time.
Yep.
In the face of PSD2. I think it's higher, but I don't think any of us know. I think this is so different, and this has just not happened before, that it's very difficult to make predictions. But
you have to change customer behavior.
Yeah,
changing customer behavior is still
the main difference. In the Netherlands, we've got Ideal, mentioned often by Robert, and I think that shows that customers are willing to use open banking like payment methods. But it's the question if other cultures in Europe will accept the way to pay up front for a transaction that they will have to consume afterwards.
Well, it's interesting because it varies country to country. Germany, you've got Sofort, obviously. Here, you've got Ideal.
Go to a payment method that will make them pay upfront.
Yeah, but in the Nordics, they're also into this sort of stuff.
In Italy, they pay a bit more. So it's going to be very difficult.
Germany is a credit adverse country, so they prefer to pay upfront.
No, they prefer to get the
You guys want to swap seats?
No, but I think that you're right. Country by country, it will be different behavior, but probably it will be in the interest, particularly of the retailers, of trying to change the behavior, because they can ultimately save cost and get the money earlier. So the retailers will have an advantage of switching over from more expensive payment methods without 100% guarantee to, let's say, more cost-efficient payment methods without dispute possibilities. So that's the interest for the retailers. That's not exactly the same as the interest for the consumers, because they don't care about the cost that the retailer has. They don't know that, and they don't care. And you could argue and say, okay, in theory, they'd prefer to have disputable payment methods because then at least they have. So probably the challenge is, how will those retailers convince the consumers for their particular trusted brand, which they are, to convince them to use over to this cheaper payment method? And in the travel sector, for instance, yeah, that could be an interesting one, because I buy a lot of tickets at a certain airline, and if indeed they would give me upgrades, free seating, whatever things in exchange for this, and if I trust this company, and if I trust this company in such a way that I feel confident that if I have a dispute, I can call them, because that becomes then the trust part. And I would do that with certain companies. And there probably will be other companies where I say, well, yeah, but if you work for Ryanair, well, maybe you.
I work for Booking, but if you give me a free check seat on a company I don't trust, Ryanair, even WOW Airlines, which is gone now.
Would you buy Qualitalia tomorrow?
Maybe not.
But I think that consumers will make a judgment on every individual payment. Well, probably they would have confidence in Booking as well as a travel agent, and say, okay, if there is an issue with my flight, regardless whether it was Hotel X or flight whatever, and that's then more the question of, do I, as a brand, as a retail brand or as a travel brand, am I able to build enough confidence for my consumers that they have confidence that if there is a conflict that we will get it resolved.
And then we better give this guy up the back.
I think so too. Last question. I think we can talk about this for hours.
Yeah.
There in the back.
Yeah. It's been standing up all night.
Toilets are there. But that's not required for the license itself.
No.
The technical connections, they're required for having a workable product, but you don't need to have the technical infrastructure in place already before you can get the license.
True. Yeah. But in order to get that, you need to connect to the banks also, of course.
Yeah.
And all those APIs, you just said 10 banks only in the Netherlands that you have to connect to, but I just did a research, and those sandboxes that are currently available, given they are following the same standard, they could be further apart with connecting to the different sandboxes. So even in the APIs, there are huge differences. In short, the investment that P2P actually needs to make to get a license are huge. And PSD2 is actually coming to life. One of the reasons to compete more with banks, compete with bigger institutions. And how can we make sure that we are all here together, work together to actually make these two success, which is meant to be, by competing with each other in a small level and not make sure that the Google and the Amazon are coming here, get a PC2 license for relatively cheap for them, and blow all of our fintech ideas away. Mm. So what's your vision on that?
The last part of it.
This is a nice one for you, Stefan.
Okay, so I'm not going to try to put any company in negative light. What you see right now is that this layer, that the connectivity layer is right now evolving. Yeah? So right now, we don't have anyone building, or not so many companies building consumer-facing apps or payments apps, but everyone is currently focused on building this connectivity just to banks, yeah, to enable basic services. One company in the UK which has got 20 million funding from Goldman Sachs to build this layer connecting banks.
Yep.
And I think this is happening country by country right now. And that will, of course, make it easier for TPP to enter this market, because they only need to build one local connection, probably. No? So that will make it easier, but also it puts responsibility of the monitoring of the new network participant on this connectivity layer. No? So and probably there also will be some supervision required. Yeah, so that's the one point. And I think we actually had this conversation, the question that you asked. No? So what we understand how the world is trying to spin is that Europe is looking to build something in-house. Yeah? So we're trying to look for something that works across Europe, not just in one country, not just in one niche of fintech. Maybe it makes us a little bit independent from existing global payment schemes. And I think that's a general voice of the regulator, that's at least you can see in the media, no? So especially German ECB, German Central Bank had speaking about this quite openly. You hear this also from the European Union. So I think this is indeed an opportunity, you know, so to build the WeChat Pay of Europe. So there just needs to be one bold enough with big pockets to do it.
That being said, I think we can talk about it for hours. Like I said, let's do that at the bar with a beer. Before we do that, thanks for you guys for the panel. Thanks to Arjan. Thanks to Daniel as well. And a special thanks to our marketing team, Jelmer, Verna, and Laura, who have organized this. And thanks to all of you guys for this interactive discussion, of course. Enjoy the drinks at the bar. Hope to see you there. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for our first Payments and Cards Network podcast. If you'd like to get more information or would like to get involved in our podcast series, make sure to write to marketing@teampcn.com, and we'll be sure to get back to you. This is Lewis Howard, Managing Director of Payments and Cards Network USA. Until next time for our podcast series.